Chapter 67. Ocean Poet. At the end of the retreat season, many monks bid farewell to the Buddha and then took to the road to spread the Dharma. Venerable Puna, one of the Buddha's most capable and respected bhikkhus, told the Buddha of his plans to return to his native region in order to teach the Dharma. He was from the island Sunaparanta, located in the Eastern Sea. The Buddha said, "I have heard that your native land is still largely uncivilized, and that many of the people there are known for their fierce nature and violent conflicts. I'm not sure whether it is a good idea for you to go there to teach." Venerable Puna responded, "Lord, it is precisely because the people are still fierce and uncivilized that I wish to go teach there. I can show them the way of compassion and nonviolence. I believe I will be successful." "Puna, what if they scream and curse at you?" "Respected Buddha, that is nothing. At least they won't be throwing rocks and garbage at me." "What if they do throw rocks and garbage at you?" "Respected Buddha, that will still be nothing. At least they won't be beating me with sticks and clubs." "What if they do beat you with sticks and clubs?" Venerable Puna laughed. "I would still consider them gentle. After all, they won't be killing me." "Puna, what if they do kill you?" "I doubt very much that will come to pass, Lord. But if it does, I would consider dying on behalf of the way of compassion and nonviolence a meaningful death that may even help demonstrate the teaching. Everyone must die. I would not regret dying for the way." The Buddha praised him. "You are wonderful, Puna. You possess the courage to spread the Dharma in Sunaparanta. Actually, I only asked all these questions for the benefit of the other bhikkhus standing here. I have no doubts about your abilities and your practice of nonviolence." Venerable Puna had formerly been a merchant. He and his brother-in-law traded local products from Sunaparanta with merchants in Savatthi. They traveled by boat and ox cart. One day, while waiting for a shipment of goods to arrive in Savatthi, Puna met a group of bhikkhus out begging. He was deeply impressed by their serene demeanor, so he went to Jetavana to hear the Buddha give a Dharma talk. By the end of the Dharma talk, Puna no longer desired to be a merchant. He wanted to become a bhikkhu. He gave the rest of his goods and money to his brother-in-law and was ordained in the Buddha Sangha. He made quick progress in his practice and was soon a capable teacher himself. He traveled throughout Kosala and Mogoda, spreading the Dharma. All the bhikkhus were confident he would succeed in his native land. The next spring, the Buddha returned east. He stopped in Vesali and Kampa. He followed the river to the sea where he taught along the coast. One day, as they stood at the sea's edge, Ananda said to him, "Lord, listening to the sound of the tide and looking out over the waves, I follow my breath and dwell in the present moment. My mind and body find perfect ease. I find that the ocean renews me." The Buddha nodded. Another day, the bhikkhus stopped to talk with a fisherman. Venerable Ananda asked him his feelings about the sea. The man was tall and handsome, his skin bronzed by the sun. He told Ananda, "I love many things about the ocean. First, the sandy shores gently slope downward into the water, which makes it easier for us to drag our boats and nets. Second, the ocean stays in the same place. You always know where to find it. Third, the ocean never holds on to a corpse, but thrusts it back onto the shore. Fourth, all rivers, Ganga, Yamuna, Achiravati, Sarabu, Nahi, empty into the ocean and leave their own names behind. The sea receives them all. Fifth, even though rivers empty into the sea day and night, the ocean remains at the same level. Sixth, seawater is always salty. Seventh, the ocean contains beautiful coral, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Eighth, the ocean gives refuge to thousands of living beings, from enormous creatures that measure nearly 100 feet in length to creatures no bigger than the eye of a needle or a speck of dust. I think you can see, Venerable, how much I love the ocean." Ananda looked at the fisherman with admiration. Though he was a simple fisherman, he spoke like a poet. Ananda turned to the Buddha and said, "How eloquently this man has praised the sea! He loves it in the way I love the way of enlightenment. May we hear more of your teaching?" The Buddha smiled and pointed to some large rocks. He said, "Let's go sit on those rocks while I speak to you of the special characteristics of the way of enlightenment." They all followed the Buddha, including the fisherman. When everyone was seated, the Buddha began. Our brother fisherman has described 8 wonderful characteristics of the sea. I will now describe 8 wonderful characteristics of the true path. First, the Dharma is not unlike the ocean, whose shores slope gently downward, enabling the fishermen to more easily pull their boats and nets into the sea. In the teaching, every person can progress from the easy to the difficult, from the low to the high, from the superficial to the profound. The Dharma is broad enough to accommodate every temperament. Anyone can enter the path, whether young or old, educated or unschooled. Every person can find methods suitable to his or her individual needs. Second, as the ocean stays in the same place, so does the Dharma. The principles of the teaching never change. The precepts have been clearly transmitted. The true Dharma dwells wherever people study and practice the principles and precepts. The Dharma cannot be lost or misplaced. Third, as the ocean never holds onto a corpse, the Dharma does not tolerate ignorance, laziness, or violation of the precepts. Any person who does not maintain the practice will find himself eventually thrust from the community. Fourth, as the ocean receives all rivers equally, the Dharma receives from all castes equally. And just as rivers that empty into the sea leave their own names behind, those who enter the path leave their caste, lineage, and former positions behind in order to take the name of Bhikkhu. Fifth, just as the level of the sea remains constant, the Dharma remains constant no matter how many or how few people follow it. The Dharma cannot be measured by numbers. Sixth, as seawater is always salty, the Dharma, though it be revealed in countless ways, and though there be countless methods of practice, has only one taste. That is the taste of liberation. If the teaching does not lead to liberation, it is not true teaching. Seventh, as the ocean contains coral, mother of pearl, and precious stones, the Dharma contains sublime and precious teachings, like the Four Noble Truths, the 4 Right Efforts, the 5 Faculties, the 5 Powers, the 7 Factors of Awakening, and the Noble Eightfold Path. Eighth, as the ocean provides a safe refuge to thousands of living beings, whether they are as tiny as a grain of sand or several hundred feet in length, the Dharma provides refuge to all, whether they are unschooled children or great beings like the Bodhisattvas. There are countless students of the Dharma who have attained the fruits of stream enterer, once returner, never returner, or arhat. Like the ocean, the Dharma is a source of inspiration and an immeasurable treasure. Venerable Ananda joined his palms and looked at the Buddha. He said, Lord, you are a spiritual master, and you are also a poet. Chapter 68. 3 Wondrous Gates. After leaving the coast, the Buddha visited Pataliputta in Vaishali, and then headed towards his homeland. Upon reaching the town of Samagama in Sakya, he learned that Nataputta, leader of the Nigantha sect, had died, and that his followers had divided into 2 bitter camps. Each side denounced the other for false interpretation of doctrine, and each vied for the laity's support. The people were dismayed and confused and did not know which side to follow. The novice Kunda, Sariputta's attendant, explained the Nigantha dispute to Ananda. He was aware of all the details because he had lived for a time in Pava where Nataputta taught. Ananda told the Buddha about the conflict and then added in a worried tone of voice, Lord, I hope there will be no split in the Sangha after you pass away. The Buddha patted Ananda on the shoulder and said, Ananda, do any of the bhikkhus presently argue over the contents of the teaching? Do they argue about the 4 establishments of mindfulness, the 4 right efforts, the 5 faculties, the 5 powers, the 7 factors of awakening, or the Noble Eightfold Path? No, I have never seen any bhikkhus arguing with each other over the teaching. But you are still among us. We take refuge in your virtue. We all listen to you, and our studies proceed peacefully. But when you are gone, disagreements may arise over the precepts, how best to organize the Sangha, or how to spread the teaching. If conflicts erupt, many could grow disheartened and even lose their faith in the path. The Buddha consoled him. Don't worry, Ananda. If arguments and conflicts arise in the Sangha over the contents of the teaching, such as the 4 establishments of mindfulness, the 4 right efforts, the 5 faculties, the 5 powers, the 7 factors of awakening, or the Noble Eightfold Path, that would be cause for worry. Disagreements over small matters concerning the practice of the Sangha organization and dissemination of the teaching are not worth worrying about. Despite the Buddha's reassurances, Venerable Ananda remained unconvinced. Only recently he had learned that in Vesali, Venerable Sunakata, who had once been the Buddha's attendant, had abandoned the Sangha out of personal dissatisfaction. He was organizing lectures at which he denounced the Buddha and the Sangha. He exclaimed that the monk Gautama was no more than an ordinary man who possessed no special insight. He said that Gautama's teaching only spoke about liberating oneself and showed no concern for society as a whole. Sunakata was sowing seeds of confusion. Venerable Sariputta was also aware of the situation and shared Ananda's concern. Ananda knew that seeds of discontent were also being sown in Rajagaha. Several bhikkhus, under the leadership of Venerable Devadatta, were secretly trying to organize a new sangha independent from the Buddha. Several capable bhikkhus were cooperating with Devadatta, including Venerables Kokalika, Katamorakatisa, Kanda Devaputta, and Samudadatta. Devadatta was one of the Buddha's brightest and most capable senior disciples. Brother Sariputta had often praised him before the people and had treated him as a special friend. Ananda could not understand why Devadatta had recently grown so jealous of others, especially the Buddha himself. Ananda knew that no one had disclosed these things to the Buddha yet. He was afraid he himself would have to be the one to inform the Buddha of these sad developments before long. The next year, the Buddha returned to Savatthi for the rainy season. He dwelled at Jetavana. There he delivered the Sutra on the Dharma Seal. There is a wonderful teaching which I will speak to you about today. Please empty your minds of all other thoughts in order to calmly and peacefully hear, receive, and understand this teaching. Because certain Dharma seals are the signs of true Dharma. There are three seals which every teaching of mine bears. These are emptiness, signlessness, and aimlessness. These three characteristics are the three gates that lead to emancipation. These Dharma seals are also known as the three gates of emancipation or the three liberation gates. Because the first seal is emptiness, sunatta. Emptiness does not mean non-existence. It means that nothing exists independently. Emptiness means empty of a separate self. As you know, the belief in being and the belief in non-being are both incorrect. All dharmas depend on each other for their existence. This is because that is. This is not because that is not. This is born because that is born. This dies because that dies. Thus, the nature of emptiness is interdependence. Because practice looking at the interdependent relationships of all dharmas in order to see how all dharmas are present in each other, how one dharma contains all other dharmas. Apart from one dharma, no other dharmas can exist. Contemplate the 18 realms of the six sense organs, the six sense objects, and the six sense consciousnesses. Contemplate the five aggregates of body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. You will see that no phenomenon, no aggregate, can exist independently. All depend on each other for existence. When you see this, you will see into the empty nature of all dharmas. Once you see the empty nature of all dharmas, you will no longer chase after or run away from any dharma. You will transcend attachment, discrimination, and prejudice toward all dharmas. Contemplation on the nature of emptiness opens the first gate to freedom. Emptiness is the first liberation gate. Because the second seal is signlessness, animitta. Signlessness means to transcend the confines of perception and mental discrimination. When people are unable to see the interdependent and empty nature of all dharmas, they perceive dharmas as being separate and independent phenomena. This exists apart from that. This is independent of all other dharmas. Looking at dharmas in such a way is like taking a sword of mental discrimination and cutting up reality into small pieces. One is then prevented from seeing the true face of reality. Because all dharmas depend on each other. This is in that. This fits within that. In the one are found the all. That is the meaning of the terms interpenetration and interbeing. This is in that. That is in this. This is that. That is this. Contemplate in this way, and you will see that ordinary perception is full of error. The eyes of perception are unable to see as clearly and accurately as the eyes of understanding. The eyes of perception can mistake a rope for a snake. With the illuminating eyes of understanding, the true form of the rope reveals itself, and the image of a snake disappears. Bhikkhus, all mental concepts such as existence, non-existence, birth, death, one, many, appearing, disappearing, coming, going, defiled, immaculate, increasing and decreasing, are created by perception and mental discrimination. From the view of the unconditioned absolute, the true face of reality cannot be confined within the prisons of such concepts. Thus, all dharmas are said to be signless. Contemplate in order to dissolve all thoughts about existence, non-existence, birth, death, one, many, appearing, disappearing, coming, going, defiled, immaculate, increasing and decreasing, and you will attain liberation. Signlessness is the second liberation gate. Because the third sign is aimlessness, apanihita. Aimlessness means not chasing after anything. Why? Usually people try to avoid one dharma by chasing after another one. People pursue wealth in order to avoid poverty. The spiritual seeker rejects birth and death in order to attain liberation. But if all dharmas are contained within each other, if all dharmas are each other, how can you run away from one dharma to pursue a different one? Within birth and death lies nirvana. Within nirvana lie birth and death. Nirvana and birth and death are not two separate realities. If you reject birth and death in order to pursue nirvana, you have not yet grasped the interdependent nature of all dharmas. You have not yet grasped the empty and formless nature of all dharmas. Contemplate aimlessness in order to end once and for all your chasing and running away. Liberation and enlightenment do not exist outside of your own self. We need only open our eyes to see that we ourselves are the very essence of liberation and enlightenment. All dharmas, all beings, contain the nature of full enlightenment within themselves. Don't look for it outside yourself. If you shine the light of awareness on your own self, you will realize enlightenment immediately. Because nothing in the universe exists independently of your own consciousness, not even nirvana or liberation. Don't search for them elsewhere. Remember that the object of consciousness cannot exist independently from consciousness. Don't chase after any dharma, including Brahma, nirvana, and liberation. That is the meaning of aimlessness. You already are what you are searching for. Aimlessness is a wondrous gate that leads to freedom. It is called the third liberation gate. Bhikkhus, this is the teaching of the Dharma seals, the teaching of the three gates of emancipation. The three gates of emancipation are wondrous and sublime. Devote yourselves wholeheartedly to studying and practicing them. If you practice according to this teaching, you will surely realize liberation. When the Buddha finished giving this sutra, Venerable Sariputta stood up and bowed to the Buddha. All the other bhikkhus followed his example in order to show their deep gratitude to the Buddha. Venerable Sariputta announced to the community that there would be a special session to study the sutra the following day. He said that this sutra was immeasurably profound, and they must devote their efforts to study, practice, and understand it. Venerable Svasti saw that this sutra was related to the sutra on emptiness, which the Buddha had delivered the previous year. He saw how the Buddha was guiding his disciples from simple teachings toward ever more subtle and profound teachings. Svasti looked at the radiant and happy faces of such disciples as Mahakasapa, Sariputta, Puna, and Moggallana. Svasti remembered how the previous year they also followed Sariputta's example in bowing to the Buddha after he delivered the sutra on emptiness. He saw how deep the bond between teacher and student was. The next afternoon, Venerables Yamelu and Takula visited the Buddha at his hut. These two bhikkhus were brothers from the Brahmana caste. They were well known for their expertise in linguistics and ancient literature. When they recited the scriptures, their voices were clear as bells and as resonant as drums. They bowed to the Buddha, and he invited them to be seated. Venerable Yamelu spoke, "Lord, we would like to speak to you concerning the question of language as it relates to the dissemination of the teaching. Lord, you usually deliver your talks in Mogadi, but Mogadi is not the native tongue of many bhikkhus, and the people in some of the regions where the bhikkhus teach do not understand Mogadi. Thus, they translate the teachings into local dialects. Before we were ordained, we had the good fortune to study many dialects and languages. It is our observation that the sublime and subtle nuances of your teaching have been hampered by being translated into local dialects and idioms. We would like your permission to render all your teachings into the classical meter of the Vedic language. If all the bhikkhus studied and taught the teaching in one language, distortion and error could be avoided. The Buddha was silent for a moment. Then he said, "It would not be beneficial to follow your suggestion. The Dharma is a living reality. The words used to transmit it should be the words by the people. I do not want the teaching to be transmitted in a language that can be understood by only a few scholars. Yamelu and Tekula, I want all my disciples, both ordained and lay, to study and practice the Dharma in their native tongues. That way the Dharma will remain vital and accessible. The Dharma must be applicable to present life and compatible with local culture." Understanding the Buddha's intent, Venerables Yamelu and Tekula bowed to him and took their leave. Chapter 69. Where will the Buddha go? One day during a rainstorm, an ascetic named Uttiya came to visit the Buddha. Ananda led him into the hut and introduced him to the Buddha. The ascetic was invited to sit down, and Ananda offered him a towel to dry himself. Uttiya asked the Buddha, "Monk Gautama, is the world eternal or will it one day perish?" The Buddha smiled and said, "Ascetic Uttiya, with your consent, I will not answer that question." Uttiya then asked, "Is the world finite or infinite?" "I will not answer that question either." "Well then, are body and spirit one or two?" "I will not answer that question either." "After you die, will you continue to exist or not?" "This question too I will not answer." "Or perhaps you hold that after death you will neither continue to exist nor cease to exist?" "Ascetic Uttiya, I will not answer that question either." Uttiya looked confounded. He said, "Monk Gautama, you have refused to answer every question I've asked. What question will you answer?" The Buddha replied, "I only answer questions that pertain directly to the practice of gaining mastery over one's mind and body in order to overcome all sorrows and anxieties." "How many people in the world do you think your teaching can save?" The Buddha sat silently. Ascetic Uttiya said no more. Sensing that the ascetic felt that the Buddha didn't want to answer him or was unable to, Ananda took pity on the man and spoke up. "Ascetic Uttiya, perhaps this example will help you better understand my teacher's intent. Imagine a king who dwells in a strongly fortified palace surrounded by a wide moat and wall. There's only one entrance and exit to the palace, which is guarded day and night. The vigilant guard will only allow persons he knows into the palace. No one else is granted permission to enter. The guard has furthermore made a careful check of the palace wall to make sure there are no gaps or cracks big enough for even a kitten to squeeze through. The king sits on his throne without concern for how many people enter the palace. He knows the guard will prevent all unwelcome guests from entering. It is similar for Monk Gautama. He is not concerned with the number of people who follow his way. He is only concerned with teaching the way, which has the capacity to dissolve greed, violence, and delusion, so that those who follow the way can realize peace, joy, and liberation. Ask my teacher questions about how to master the mind and body, and he will surely answer you." Ascetic Uttiya understood Ananda's example, but because he was still entangled in questions of a metaphysical nature, he asked no more. He departed feeling somewhat unsatisfied with his encounter with the Buddha. A few days later, another ascetic named Vakagota came to visit the Buddha. He asked the Buddha questions of a similar nature. For instance, he asked, "Monk Gautama, could you please tell me whether or not there is a self?" The Buddha sat silently. He did not say a word. After asking several questions and receiving no reply, Vakagota stood up and left. After he was gone, Venerable Ananda asked the Buddha, "Lord, you speak about the non-self in your Dharma talks. Why wouldn't you answer Vakagota's questions about the self?" The Buddha replied, "Ananda, the teaching on the emptiness of self is meant to guide our meditation. It is not to be taken as a doctrine. If people take it as a doctrine, they will become entangled by it. I have often said that the teaching should be considered as a raft used to cross to the other shore, or a finger pointing to the moon. We should not become caught in the teaching. Ascetic Vakagota wanted me to hand him a doctrine, but I do not want him to become trapped by any doctrine, whether it be a doctrine of the self or the non-self. If I told him there was a self, that would contradict my teaching. But if I told him there was no self, and he clings to that as a doctrine, it would not benefit him. It is better to remain silent than to answer such questions. It is better for people to think, I do not know the answers to their questions, than for them to become trapped in narrow views. One day, Venerable Anuradha was stopped by a group of ascetics. They did not want to let him pass until he answered their question. They asked him, We have heard that Monk Gautama is a completely enlightened master, and that his teaching is subtle and profound. You are his disciple. Therefore, answer this. When Monk Gautama dies, will he continue to exist, or will he cease to exist? The ascetics told Anuradha that he must select from one of the four following possibilities. When he dies, Monk Gautama will continue to exist. When he dies, Monk Gautama will cease to exist. When he dies, Monk Gautama will both continue to exist and cease to exist. When he dies, Monk Gautama will neither continue to exist nor cease to exist. Bhikkhu Anuradha knew that none of these four responses was compatible with the true teaching. He remained silent. The ascetics did not want to accept his silence. They tried in vain to force him to select one of the four responses. At last, the Venerable said, My friends, according to my understanding, none of these four responses can accurately express the truth concerning Monk Gautama. The ascetics burst out laughing. One said, This bhikkhu must be newly ordained. He doesn't possess the ability to answer a question. No wonder he's trying to avoid giving an answer. We'd better let him go. A few days later, Venerable Anuradha presented the ascetic's question to the Buddha and said, Lord, please enlighten us so that we can better answer such questions when they arise. The Buddha said, Anuradha, it is impossible to find Monk Gautama through conceptual knowledge. Where is Monk Gautama? Anuradha, can Gautama be found in form? No, Lord. Can Gautama be found in feelings? No, Lord. Can Gautama be found in perceptions, mental formations, or consciousness? No, Lord. Well then, Anuradha, can Gautama be found outside of form? No, Lord. Can Gautama be found outside of feelings? No, Lord. Can Gautama be found outside of perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness? No, Lord. The Buddha looked at Anuradha. Where then can you find Gautama? Anuradha, right this moment, as you stand before Gautama, you cannot grab hold of him. How much less so after he dies? Anuradha, the essence of Gautama, like the essence of all dharmas, cannot be grasped by conceptual knowledge or in the categories of mental discrimination. One must see the dharmas in interdependent relation with all other dharmas. You must see Gautama in all the dharmas normally thought of as non-Gautama in order to see the true face of Gautama. Anuradha, if you want to see the essence of a lotus flower, you must see the lotus present in all the dharmas normally thought of as non-lotus, such as the sun, pond water, clouds, mud, and heat. Only by looking in this way can we tear asunder the web of narrow views, the web of mental discrimination that creates the prisons of birth, death, here, there, existence, non-existence, defiled, immaculate, increasing, and decreasing. It is the same if you want to see Gautama. The ascetic's four categories of existence, non-existence, both existence and non-existence, and neither existence nor non-existence are spider webs among spider webs, which can never take hold of the enormous bird of reality. Anuradha, reality in itself cannot be expressed by conceptual knowledge or by written and spoken language. Only the understanding that meditation brings can help us recognize the essence of reality. Anuradha, a person who has never tasted a mango cannot know its taste, no matter how many words and concepts someone else uses to describe it to him. We can only grasp reality through direct experience. That is why I have often told the bhikkhus not to lose themselves in useless discussion that wastes precious time better spent looking deeply at things. Anuradha, the nature of all dharmas is unconditioned and can be called suchness, tatata. Suchness is the wondrous nature of all dharmas. From suchness, the lotus arises. Anuradha arises from suchness. Gautama arises from suchness. We can call someone who arises from suchness a Tathagata, or one who thus comes. Arising from suchness, where do all dharmas return? All dharmas return to suchness. Returning to suchness can also be expressed by the term Tathagata, or one who thus goes. In truth, dharmas do not arise from anywhere or go to any place, because their nature is already suchness. Anuradha, the truer meaning of suchness is one who comes from nowhere and one who goes nowhere. Anuradha, from now on, I will call myself Tathagata. I like this term, because it avoids the discrimination that arises when one uses the words I and mine. Anuradha smiled and said, We know that all of us are eyes in suchness, but we will reserve the name Tathagata for you. Every time you refer to yourself as Tathagata, we will be reminded how we all have the nature of suchness, which has no beginning and no end. The Buddha smiled too and said, The Tathagata is pleased with your suggestion, Anuradha. Venerable Ananda was present at this conversation between the Buddha and Venerable Anuradha. He followed Anuradha out of the hut and suggested that they share the conversation with the rest of the community at the next day's Dharma discussion. Anuradha happily agreed. He said he would introduce the exchange by first recounting his meeting with the ascetics in Savatthi. Chapter 70. The Quail and the Falcon. Although he had never been scolded or corrected by the Buddha, Bhikkhu Sarasthi was aware of his own shortcomings. Perhaps the Buddha refrained from saying anything critical of him because he could see Sarasthi's wholehearted efforts to be master of his six senses, even if his mastery was far from complete. Whenever Sarasthi saw another bhikkhu or bhikkhuni being corrected, he took it to heart as if he himself were the one at fault. This provided him with many opportunities to deepen his practice. He especially took to heart any correction and guidance the Buddha gave to Rahula. Rahula continued to make great strides in his practice, and that benefited Sarasthi's practice as well. Once, while sitting in a forest glade with Rahula, Sarasthi expressed how fortunate he felt to be a disciple of the Buddha. He said that because he had tasted true peace, joy, and freedom, he had no more desire for the life of the world. Rahula cautioned him, While that may be true, don't give yourself too much credit too fast. The effort to continually observe and master the senses is the very foundation of the practice, and not even the most senior disciples can afford to grow lax in their practice. Rahula told Sarasthi about Bhikkhu Vangisa, a monk renowned for his intelligence and gift with language. He was, in fact, a fine poet who had composed several gathas praising the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which had earned the Buddha's compliments. When Vangisa first joined the Sangha, he studied under the guidance of Bhikkhu Nigrodhakappa in Agalava, just outside Savatthi. After Nigrodhakappa died, Vangisa went to dwell at Chittavana. One day, while out begging with Ananda, Vangisa confided that his mind was troubled, and he asked for Ananda's assistance. Ananda learned that Vangisa was disturbed by the lust he felt for the young women who came to the monastery to bring food offerings. Ananda understood that as an artist, Vangisa was easily touched by beauty. Ananda appealed to that very sense in helping Vangisa see how he could use the beauty of the path of awakening in order to transcend his desires for the kind of fleeting beauty that creates only clinging and obstacles. Ananda showed him how to shine his awareness on the objects of his contemplation in order to see clearly the empty and impermanent nature of all dharmas. Practicing according to Ananda's instructions, Vangisa learned to master the six senses. He wrote a poem about this practice, which was now well known to other monks. It went as follows. Even after donning the saffron robe, I chased after desires, like a buffalo pining after the farmer's rice. How ashamed I felt! A mighty general's son, gifted with bow and arrow, might fend off the siege of even 1,000 soldiers. Dwelling in mindfulness, I will not be defeated, even before a throng of beautiful women. I follow the Lord, who is a descendant of the sun. Serenely walking on this path, all desire is released. Becoming master of my senses, I walk forth calmly. Though met by countless obstacles, none can shake my peace. Because Vangisa was a man gifted with intelligence and talent, there were times when his pride got the better of him, and he felt a quiet disdain for some of the other monks. Luckily, thanks to his practice of mindfulness, he was able to recognize this arrogance within himself. He composed a gatha on this theme. Disciples of Gautama, overcome arrogance. The path of pride leads only to suffering. The man who silently hides his arrogance is on the road to hell, as surely as the man all bloated up by pride. Seek instead the happiness of a peaceful heart. Practice mindfulness to realize the three knowledges. True success can only come when arrogance is subdued. Thanks to his deep awareness, Vangisa was able to transcend many sorrows and obstacles, and to make great strides on the path of transformation. He attained the fruit of never-returner, confirmed by Venerable Sariputta. The day his heart and mind were opened, Vangisa composed a poem to express his gratitude to the Buddha. Intoxicated by youthful dreams, I wandered far and wide through marketplaces and countryside until at last I met the Buddha. All compassionate, he shared the wondrous teaching with me. My faith was awakened, and I donned the robes of a monk. Dwelling in awareness, focusing heart and mind, I have attained the three knowledges thanks to the awakened one. Far and wide, the Lord has sown the seeds of illumination. Because all beings dwell in darkness, he has shown the way. The Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, tranquility, joy, and freedom. His words so subtle and profound, his noble life without blame. Skillfully, he leads all beings to liberation. How deep my gratitude! Once in a special teaching session held for the younger bhikkhus, Venerable Sariputta held Bhikkhu Vangisa up as an example. He told them that in the beginning of his practice, Vangisa was sometimes troubled by certain afflictions and states of mind, but thanks to determined practice, he overcame such states and attained great understanding. Therefore, Sariputta told the young monks, don't let yourself be caught in any mental complex, whether an inferiority or a superiority complex. Practicing mindfulness, you will be aware of everything that is going on inside yourself, and nothing will be able to entangle you. Learning to master the six senses is a most wonderful method to make firm progress along the path. Listening to Rahula talk about Vangisa made Svasti feel as if he knew Vangisa. Though he had met Vangisa, he had never had a real chance to speak with him. He resolved to find an occasion to get acquainted with Venerable Vangisa, for he knew he could learn much from Vangisa's spiritual experience. Svasti remembered how the Buddha once used the image of the sea to explain the practice of mastering the six senses. The Buddha said, Bhikkhus, your eyes are a deep ocean in which are concealed sea monsters, whirlpools, and perilous currents. If you don't proceed in mindfulness, your boat will be attacked and submerged by the sea monsters, whirlpools, and perilous currents. Your ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind are also deep oceans in which are concealed sea monsters. Recalling these words, Svasti's understanding increased manifold. The six senses were indeed deep oceans whose hidden waves could rise at any moment to submerge one. Rahula's advice was well worth heeding. He should not rest on any laurels. The Buddha's teaching should be practiced continuously. One afternoon, as he sat outside his hut at Jetavana Monastery, the Buddha told the younger bhikkhus a story to remind them to observe and master their six senses and not allow themselves to be lost in forgetfulness. The Buddha recounted, one day a falcon swooped down and caught a young quail in her talons. As she flew back into the sky, the quail began to cry. He chastised himself for wandering away from where his parents had told him to stay. If only I'd listened to my parents, I would not be in this predicament. The falcon asked, and where did your parents tell you to stay, you runt? The quail answered, in the newly plowed field. To the quail's surprise, the falcon said, I can catch any quail I want any time I want. I will return you to that field and offer you one more hour of life. I'll be looking for you, and in just an hour I will catch you, break your little neck, and eat you at once. And the falcon swooped down again and released the quail in the newly plowed field. Surprisingly, the young quail immediately climbed up on a mound of newly plowed earth and began to taunt the falcon. Hey, falcon! Why wait an hour? Why don't you fly back down and try to catch me right now? Angered, the falcon tucked her wings close to her sides and shot down at full speed. But the quail quickly ducked for cover in the furrow beneath the mound of earth, and the falcon missed the quail and landed with such force that she broke her breastbone and was killed instantly. Bhikkhus, you must dwell in mindfulness at all times and master your six senses. When you leave mindfulness, you enter the domain of Mara, and danger is unavoidable. Svasti was encouraged by the number of sincere and talented young bhikkhus in the Buddha Sangha. One day, he was invited with several other monks to the home of a layperson named Citta, who lived in the village Machikasanda. It was on this outing that Svasti learned how bright one of these young bhikkhus was. Lay disciple Citta was well known for his devotion to the teaching. Because of his large and generous heart, he was deeply loved by the people, just as lay devotee Anattapindika was loved. Citta enjoyed inviting senior disciples to his home in order to offer them food and ask them questions on the Dharma. On this particular day, he invited 10 senior monks and 2 young monks, Svasti and Isidatta. After the monks were finished eating, Citta bowed to them respectfully and then asked if he could sit before them on a low stool. He asked them the following question. Respected venerables, I have heard the Brahmajala Sutra, in which the Buddha discusses the 62 false views of contemporary sects. I have also heard the questions raised by members of other sects concerning life, death, and the soul, such as, is the world finite or infinite? Temporal or everlasting? Are body and mind one or two? Will the Tathagata still exist after his death or cease to exist? Will he both exist and cease to exist? Or will he neither exist nor cease to exist? Venerables, what gives rise to these esoteric kinds of views and questions? Not one of the bhikkhus ventured to answer Citta's question, even after he repeated it 3 times. Svasti was embarrassed and felt his ears turning warm. Suddenly Isidatta spoke. He turned toward the senior bhikkhus and asked, Respected elders, may I respond to lay disciple Citta's question? The senior monks answered, Bhikkhu, you may answer his question if you wish. Turning back to Citta, Isidatta said, Sir, such views and questions arise because people still cling to a false view of the self. If the idea of a separate self were abandoned, people would no longer have a need to cling to such views or ask such questions. Citta was visibly impressed by the young bhikkhu's response. He said, Please, venerable, could you explain this more clearly? People without a chance to be exposed to and to study the way of awakening generally think of the body as being the same as oneself, or they think that the self is contained in the body and the body is contained in the self. Likewise, they consider feelings to be the same as the self, or they think that feelings are contained in the self and the self is contained in feelings. Such people hold the same views as regards their perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. They are caught in a false view of self. It is precisely because they are caught in a false view of self that they become entrapped by the 62 false views discussed in the Brahmajala Sutra, and by questions about the finite and infinite, temporal and everlasting, one and two, existing and ceasing to exist. Lay disciple Citta, such questions and views are rendered meaningless when, through dedicated study and practice, one breaks through the false view of self. Increasingly impressed by the young bhikkhu, Citta respectfully asked Isidatta, Venerable, where are you from? I come from Avanti. Venerable, I have heard about a young man from Avanti named Isidatta who became a bhikkhu. It is said that he is remarkably bright and able. Though I have heard his name, I have never seen him. Have you ever met him? Yes, Citta, I have met him. Then, Venerable, can you tell me where this talented young monk is at present? Isidatta did not answer. In fact, Citta had already guessed that the young bhikkhu sitting before him was Isidatta. He asked, Can it be that you yourself are Bhikkhu Isidatta? Yes, sir, replied Isidatta. Citta was overjoyed and exclaimed, This is a great honor for me. Respected Venerable Isidatta, my mango grove and private residence in Machikasanda are refreshing places equipped with every convenience. I hope you will come to visit us often. We offer you whatever you may need, food, robes, medicine, or a place to stay. Isidatta did not say anything. The bhikkhus thanked Citta and departed. Svasti later heard that Isidatta never returned to Citta's home. Isidatta did not desire lavish praise or offerings, not even from such a well-respected man as Citta. The Yosvasti did not meet Isidatta again for some time. The image of the bright and humble bhikkhu remained engraved on his mind. Svasti pledged to follow Isidatta's example and to seek him out whenever he had a chance to pass through Avanti. Svasti knew how much the Buddha loved young bhikkhus who showed determination, wisdom, and concern for the welfare and happiness of others. The Buddha expressed how greatly he depended on these young monks to transmit the teaching to future generations. However, Svasti observed how devoted the Buddha was in teaching all the bhikkhus, regardless of their individual abilities. Some monks encountered more difficulties than others. There was one monk who abandoned the community 6 times, but was still welcomed back by the Buddha for another effort. The Buddha never ceased to offer kindly encouragement to those monks who found it difficult to remember even such simple practices as the 16 methods of observing the breath. There was a monk named Badali who lived at Jetavana. The Buddha was well aware of Badali's shortcomings, but he chose to overlook them in order to provide the bhikkhu with an opportunity to transform himself. Badali seemed incapable of following a number of monastic disciplines. For instance, during meals, every bhikkhu was expected to remain seated until he had finished eating. Standing up during the meal for second helpings or to tend to other tasks was not allowed. This discipline was called one sitting for meals. Badali never managed to remember this discipline. His behavior around the monastery was a frequent cause of distress to the other bhikkhus. The Buddha called him aside a number of times and taught him to ask himself this question every morning upon arising. What can I do today to contribute to the community's happiness? But after several months, Badali appeared to have made little, if any, progress. A number of bhikkhus grew impatient with Badali and spoke harshly to him. Aware of this, one day the Buddha addressed the community. He said, "Bhikkhus, although an individual in the Sangha may possess a number of serious flaws, there undoubtedly remains within him at least a few seeds of faith and love. We must relate to such an individual in a way that will protect and nurture those seeds of faith and love, lest they too perish. Take the example of a person who loses an eye in an accident. His family and friends will do everything in their power to protect his remaining eye, because they know how bleak his future will be if he loses it. Thus, bhikkhus, help protect the seeds of faith and love in your brother by treating him kindly." Svasti was present when the Buddha spoke these words. He was deeply moved by the Buddha's loving attitude. He looked up and saw Ananda wiping away tears and knew that Ananda too had been touched. Although the Buddha was kind-hearted and gentle, he could also be stern when the occasion called for it. A person who could not be helped by the Buddha was truly a person without a future. One day, Svasti was present when a short but impressive conversation took place between the Buddha and a man called Kesi, who was a well-known horse trainer. The Buddha asked Kesi, "Can you please explain to us how you go about training a horse?" Kesi answered, "Lord, horses have different temperaments. Some are quite docile and can be trained by the simple use of gentle words. Others are more difficult and require a firm hand along with gentle methods. Others are still more stubborn and require the use of firm discipline alone." The Buddha laughed and asked, "What do you do when you encounter a horse that won't respond to any of these 3 methods? "Lord, in that situation, it is necessary to kill the horse. If it is allowed to live with the other horses, it will spoil them all. Lord, for my part, I would like to know how you train your disciples." The Buddha smiled. He said, "I do the same as you. Some monks respond to gentleness alone. Others require firmness along with gentleness. Others can only make progress when given stern discipline." "And what do you do in the case of a monk who doesn't respond to any of those methods?" The Buddha said, "I do as you do. I kill him." The horse trainer's eyes widened in alarm. "What? You kill him? I thought you were against killing." The Buddha explained, "I do not kill him in the same way you kill a horse. When a person does not respond to any of the 3 methods we've just discussed, we refuse to let him join the Sangha of bhikkhus. I do not accept him as my student. That is an extreme misfortune. Being refused the chance to practice the Dharma in community is to lose an opportunity that only arises once in 1,000 lifetimes. What is that, if not death, to the spiritual life? It isn't just a pity for the person refused. It is as much a pity for me. for I feel great love and concern for that person. I never stop hoping that one day he will open himself up to the practice and come back to us. Long ago, Svasti had heard the Buddha scold and counsel Rahula. He had also witnessed the Buddha correct a number of other bhikkhus. He now understood more deeply the profound love behind the Buddha's rebukes. Svasti also knew how much the Buddha loved him, even though the Buddha never said so aloud. Svasti needed only to look into the Buddha's eyes to know. That night, the Buddha received a guest, and Ananda asked Svasti to prepare tea. The guest was a warrior with proud and aristocratic bearing who traveled with a shining sword slung across his back. He dismounted his steed outside Jetavana and left his sword tucked in the saddle. Sariputta showed him to the Buddha's hut. He was a man of impressive height. His strides were long, and he had a piercing gaze. Ananda told Svasti that the warrior's name was Rohitasa. When Svasti entered the hut to serve tea, he found Rohitasa and Sariputta sitting before the Buddha on low stools. Ananda was standing behind the Buddha. After serving the three men tea, Svasti stood next to Ananda behind the Buddha. The men drank their tea in silence. After a long pause, Rohitasa spoke. "Lord, is there any world in which there is no birth, old age, sickness, or death? Is there any world in which beings never die? By what means of travel can one leave this world of birth and death behind in order to arrive at a world in which death does not exist?" The Buddha answered, "There are no means of travel by which you can leave this world of birth and death, no matter how fast you might go, even if you travel at the speed of light." Rohitasa joined his palms and said, "You speak the truth. I know for a fact that it is not possible to escape this world of birth and death through any means of travel, no matter how fast one is able to go. I can recall a past life in which I possessed supernatural powers and was able to fly through the air faster than an arrow. With one step, I could leap from the Eastern Sea all the way to the Western Sea. I was determined to escape the world of birth, old age, sickness, and death in order to find a world in which beings were no longer oppressed by birth and death. Day after day, I traveled at great speed, never stopping to eat or drink, rest or sleep. For 100 years, I went at that great speed, but arrived nowhere. Until one day, I died by the side of a road. Lord, your words are indeed true. Truly, one can never escape the world of birth and death by any means of travel, even if one can fly at the speed of light." The Buddha said, "I did not say, however, that one cannot transcend the world of birth and death. Listen, Rohitasa, you can indeed transcend this world of birth and death. I will show you the path by which you may do so. In your very own body, 6 feet tall, the world of birth and death has its origins, and in that same body are the means to transcend the world of birth and death. Contemplate your body, Rohitasa. Shine your awareness on the world of birth and death as it unfolds in your own tall body. Contemplate until you can see the truth of impermanence, emptiness, birthlessness, and deathlessness of all dharmas. Before you, the world of birth and death will dissolve, and the world of birthlessness and deathlessness will reveal itself. You will be freed from every sorrow and fear. You do not need to travel anywhere in order to leave the world of suffering and death. You need only look deeply into the nature of your own body." Svasti noticed how Sariputta's eyes glistened like stars as he listened to the Buddha. Warrior Rohitasa's face also radiated happiness. Svasti was profoundly moved. Who could fathom how wondrous and majestic the Buddha's teaching was? It was like a piece of epic music. More clearly than ever, Svasti saw how the key to liberation might lay right in his own hand. Chapter 71. The Art of Stringing a Sitar. When the retreat season ended, the Buddha returned south. He stopped by Deer Park in Isipatana, the place he had delivered his first Dharma talk on the Four Noble Truths 36 years earlier. Though it seemed like only yesterday, much had changed since then. Since the first turning of the wheel of Jirma, the Dharma had been carried throughout all the countries in the Ganga Basin. The local people in Isipatana had built a stupa to commemorate the first turning, and a monastery had been built where many bhikkhus lived and practiced. After teaching the Dharma and encouraging the community there, the Buddha departed for Gaya. He stopped by Uruvela to visit the ancient Bodhi tree, which he found lovelier and greener than ever. Many huts were now scattered throughout the forest. King Bimbisara was also planning to build a stupa that would commemorate the spot where the Buddha attained awakening. The Buddha stopped to visit the village children. They were no different from the children he met years ago. The buffalo boy Svasti was now 47 years old and a respected elder in the Sangha. The village children gathered ripe papayas to offer to the Buddha. Every child in the village could recite the three refuges. From Gaya, the Buddha headed northeast to Rajagaha. As soon as he reached the capital, he headed for Vulture Peak. There he met Venerable Punna, who told him about his work teaching the Dharma on Sunaparanta Island. Punna had just completed a retreat season there with several other bhikkhus. The number of people in Sunaparanta who had taken refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha had already risen to 500. Throughout the following days, the Buddha visited the spiritual centers scattered throughout the region. One night, while sitting in meditation at one of the centers, he heard a monk chanting sutras. There was something disturbing about the voice, as though the monk was tired and discouraged. The Buddha could tell that the monk was encountering difficulties in his practice. The next morning, he asked Venerable Ananda about it, and learned that the monk chanting the sutras in the night was Sona. The Buddha remembered meeting Sona several years before in Savatthi. Venerable Sona Kutakarma was ordained under the guidance of Venerable Mahakakana and studied with him for several years on Pavata Mountain in the Kororagara region. Sona was a young man from a wealthy family. He was refined and intelligent, but had a frail constitution. He had to make a great effort to endure the homeless life of a bhikkhu, in which he ate only one meal a day and slept beneath the trees. But his devotion to the practice never wavered. After a year, he was brought by his teacher to meet the Buddha in Savatthi. That first time in Savatthi, Buddha asked Sona, "Sona, are you enjoying good health? Are you experiencing any difficulties in your practice, in begging, or in spreading the Dharma?" Sona answered, "Lord, I am very happy. I am not experiencing any difficulties." The Buddha instructed Ananda to prepare a place for Sona to sleep that night in the Buddha's hut. Venerable Ananda placed another bed in the hut. That night, the Buddha sat in meditation outside until 3 a.m. Aware of that, Sona was unable to fall asleep. When the Buddha entered the hut, he asked Sona, "Aren't you asleep yet?" "No, Lord, I'm still awake." "Aren't you sleepy? Well, then, why don't you recite some gathas you have memorized?" Venerable Sona recited the 16 gathas contained in the Sutra on the Full Awareness of Breathing. His voice was as clear as a bell. He did not stumble over any word or leave any word out. The Buddha praised him. "You recite most beautifully. How many years has it been since you were ordained?" "Lord, it has been a little more than a year. I have the experience of only one retreat season." That was the first time the Buddha and Sona met. Now, when the Buddha heard Sona's chanting, he knew that Sona had overexerted himself. He asked Ananda to accompany him to Sona's hut. Seeing the Buddha, Sona stood up at once to greet him. Buddha asked both Sona and Ananda to be seated beside him, and then he asked Sona, "Before you became a monk, you were a musician, were you not? You specialized in the 16-string sitar, didn't you?"
"Yes, Lord, that is correct."
The Buddha asked Sona, "If you play the sitar while the strings are slack, what is the result?" Sona answered, "Lord, if the strings are slack, the sitar will be out of tune."
"And what if the strings are too taut?"
"Lord, if the strings are too taut, the strings are more likely to break."
"And if the strings are just right, neither too slack nor too taut?"
"Lord, if the strings are just right, the sitar will provide fine music."
"Just so, Sona. If one is idle or lazy, one will not make progress in the practice. But if one tries too hard, one will suffer fatigue and discouragement."
"Sona, know your own strength. Don't force your body and mind beyond their limits. Only then can you attain the fruits of practice." Venerable Sona stood up and bowed to the Buddha to express his gratitude for the Buddha's insight. One afternoon, physician Jivaka visited the Buddha. He found the Buddha returning from bamboo forest and asked if he might walk up with him to his hut on Vulture Peak. Jivaka watched with admiration as the Buddha climbed the stone steps. The Buddha, now 72 years old,
was as healthy and energetic as ever. He walked with relaxed, leisurely steps, one hand carrying his bowl, the other lifting the corner of his robe. Venerable Ananda walked in the same manner. Jivaka offered to take the Buddha's bowl, and the Buddha handed it to him with a smile. He said, "But you know the Tathagata has climbed this mountain hundreds of times, always carrying his own bowl without difficulty." The carefully carved stone steps that wound up the mountainside had been a gift from King Bimbisara, Jivaka's father. When they climbed the last of them, the Buddha invited Jivaka to sit with him on a large rock outside his hut. Jivaka inquired about the Buddha's health and travels. Then he looked first at Venerable Ananda, and then at the Buddha. In a solemn voice he said, "Lord, I feel I must tell you about the situation here. Events taking place in the Sangha are directly related to the current political situation in the kingdom. I believe you should know what is happening." The physician told the Buddha that it had become clear that Venerable Devadatta desired to replace the Buddha as the leader of the Sangha. He already had considerable support among many bhikkhus, as well as among the ruling elite. Venerable Kokalika was his chief advisor. He also had the backing of Venerables Katamorakatisa, Kandadeviputta, and Samudadatta, all of whom had large numbers of students. Venerable Devadatta was both intelligent and eloquent. He was deeply respected by many bhikkhus and lay disciples. He had not come out and stated directly that he was opposed to the Buddha or the Buddha's senior disciples, but he made frequent allusions to the Buddha's advancing years, questioning whether he still possessed the ability to guide the Sangha. He had even insinuated that the Buddha's approach to the teaching was too outdated to meet the needs of young people. Devadatta enjoyed support from several wealthy disciples. Prince Ajatasattu, for reasons Jivaka was unable to understand, was Devadatta's most devoted supporter. As much as King Bimbisara revered the Buddha, Ajatasattu revered Devadatta. He had a large spiritual center built for Devadatta on Gayasisa Mountain, the very place where the Buddha had delivered the Fire Sutra to the Kasapa brothers and their 1,000 disciples. The prince personally brought food offerings to the center every few days. Merchants and politicians, wanting to get in the good graces of the prince, brought offerings and attended Devadatta's Dharma talks as well. Devadatta's influence was growing daily. Already, 300 to 400 bhikkhus had pledged their support to him. Jivaka looked at the Buddha and then lowered his voice. "Lord, I do not consider the things I have just recounted sufficient to cause worry on their own, but there is one thing that does concern me greatly. I have learned that Ajatasattu is impatient to assume the throne in order to implement his own agendas. He feels that our father has monopolized the throne for too long, in the same way that Venerable Devadatta is impatient for you to pass the mantle of leadership in. It is, in fact, my belief that Venerable Devadatta has planted some dangerous thoughts in the prince's head. Lord, I receive this impression every time I visit the palace to tend after the royal family's health. If something unexpected were to happen to King Bimbisara, you and your Sangha could be implicated. Please, Lord, take heed." The Buddha answered, "Thank you, Jivaka, for telling the Tathagata about the situation. It is important to know what is going on. Don't worry. I will see to it that the Sangha is not dragged into any unfortunate circumstances." Jivaka bowed to the Buddha and returned down the mountain. The Buddha instructed Ananda not to speak to anyone about what Jivaka had shared. 10 days later, the Buddha gave a Dharma talk to a gathering of 3,000 disciples at Bamboo Forest. King Bimbisara was among those present. The Buddha spoke about the 5 powers necessary to nourish the fruits of enlightenment. They are confidence, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and true understanding. When the Buddha had finished speaking, and before anyone else had a chance to ask him any questions, Venerable Devadatta stood and bowed to the Buddha. He said, "Lord, you are now advanced in years. Your health is no longer what it once was. You deserve to rest undisturbed and to lead a life free of any irritations for the final years of your life. The task of leading the Sangha is too heavy for you. Lord, please retire. I would be willing to serve as leader of the bhikkhus." The Buddha looked at Devadatta. He answered, "Devadatta, thank you for your concern, but the Tathagata still possesses good health and strength adequate to lead the Sangha." Venerable Devadatta turned to the community. 300 bhikkhus stood up and joined their palms. Devadatta said to the Buddha, "There are many other bhikkhus who agree with me. I have the ability to lead the Sangha. Allow me to relieve you of your burden." The Buddha said, "Enough, Devadatta, say no more. There are several senior disciples who possess abilities greater than yours, and I have not asked any of them to assume the leadership of the Sangha. How much less would I be inclined to transfer the leadership to you? You do not yet possess the ability to lead the community of bhikkhus." Venerable Devadatta felt humiliated before the great gathering. His face turned red, and he sat back down in anger. The following day at Vulture Peak, Venerable Ananda confided to the Buddha, "Lord, I feel great pain over my brother Devadatta's actions. I am afraid that he will seek some form of revenge against you, since you criticized him in front of the community. I am afraid a schism may occur in the Sangha. With your permission, I would like to speak privately with Devadatta and offer him some counsel." The Buddha said, "Ananda, I spoke severely to Devadatta before the king and community because I wanted to make it clear that I have not chosen Devadatta to succeed me as leader of the bhikkhus. Any actions he undertakes now will be in his own name. Ananda, if you think that speaking with him will help him calm down, please do so." A few days later, Jivaka paid a visit to the Buddha. He informed the Buddha that he had heard that Devadatta was plotting to create a great division in the Sangha, but by what means, he did not yet know.